Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's October 22nd, Wednesday, and what do we have next time?
Test.
Yeah, we've got a test on the 27th. That's Monday, and it's just going to be over three chapters. Here are your chapters 7, 8, and 9. So it's all just basically nervous system, right? Introduction to nervous system. So know your different cell types and what they do in terms of know the different kinds of neuroglia, different kinds of neurons and what their function is, where you find them, for instance. Central nervous system, and then autonomic nervous system is what we covered last time. And intro to now this was the long chapter. Oh yeah, it's coming back to me, because here you have to know what action potentials and graded potentials and all your receptor theory. And so what kind of receptor is going to cause a stimulus or excitation? What kind of receptor might cause excitation? If it's an ionotropic kind of receptor, is it going to activate a potassium channel or a sodium channel? A sodium channel, right? Because sodium is going to go from outside the cell to inside the cell, causing depolarization, bringing that cell up to a threshold, which then will start an action potential. All right, so what kind of receptor channel is going to be inhibitory? It's going to be a potassium channel, right? So potassium can leave the cell. That will hyperpolarize the membrane, driving it farther away from threshold. All right, autonomic nervous system. Real important chapter in your book, so don't ever forget any of that information on the autonomic nervous system. It's very important in how people regulate their bodies, and it needs the help at certain times when you're in the hospital, for instance. So how would you compare and contrast a somatic motor pathway compared to an autonomic motor pathway? So for instance, starting with skeletal, right, how would we diagram just a somatic motor pathway? So you have a cell body, and it goes where? All the way to the effector organ. And what's going to be an effector organ? What kind of muscle? Skeletal muscle, right? All right, so it's just one neuron all the way. And this right here is a synapse. What kind of synapse is that? Okay. What are the two general kinds of synapses? Yeah, electrical and chemical. So is this an electrical or a chemical one? That's chemical. What's the chemical that goes across that carries the information? That's acetylcholine, right? So acetylcholine would be the neurotransmitter. This synapse right here has a special name. What's that special name? If this is a neuron and this is a muscle, this is a special junction. The neuromuscular junction, right? Okay. And acetylcholine is released at this synapse. But we learned a lot about receptors the last number of chapters. And remember that one particular neurotransmitter can have numerous effects in the body. Sometimes it can be excitatory. Sometimes it can be inhibitory. So how do you explain how one kind of neurotransmitter can have opposite effects in different parts of the body? Because in different tissues in the body, you can have different kinds of receptors. So what kind of receptor is in muscle? What kind of receptor is in the neuromuscular junction? So when this motor neuron sends an action potential, what's the effect on this skeletal muscle right here? Can it ever ignore that signal, or what's it going to do? Because what kind of muscle is this? It's skeletal, but what does that mean in terms of control? Is that autonomic control or voluntary control? It's voluntary. So that means that this muscle is under the control of your cerebral cortex. So when your cerebral cortex makes a decision to contract the muscle, this nerve and this muscle right here should never make a decision to the contrary. Right? If you want to reach out and grab a glass of water, does your muscle ever say, no, I don't want to do that? Sometimes, okay, maybe if you're exercising or something, but generally speaking, no. Your muscles just follow your commands from your cerebral cortex, right? So it is always excitatory. So what kind of receptor Let's talk about that receptor a little bit. Okay, it's a nicotinic kind of receptor, right? And a nicotinic receptor is always going to be excitatory, which means what's going to happen to the resting membrane potential of this muscle cell if it's excitatory? It's going to, what are your choices? Depolarize or hyperpolarize? So what would be your choice? Depolarize to go up the threshold. And how would we depolarize a muscle cell? By opening up what kind of channel? A sodium channel. Right, so at the neuromuscular junction, these are nicotinic receptors. All right, for acetylcholine, so it's a, what we just call a ligand-gated sodium channel. And that is always excitatory. That's going to cause that muscle to contract. And we looked at, we are going to look at excitation-contraction coupling and exactly why that muscle contracts in the next couple chapters later on in the course. All right, so this is a somatic motor pathway. What about autonomic? So here's the cell body in the central nervous system, spinal cord, for instance. So this is going to be an example of a sympathetic neuron. How many neurons does it take? It takes two. And what do we call these neurons? Okay, so this thing right here is what we call a ganglion. So this is the preganglionic fiber, and this is the postganglionic fiber. And what's the neurotransmitter that's used in all autonomic ganglia? It's going to be acetylcholine as well, right? Acetylcholine. All right, so how many different divisions of the autonomic nervous system are there? You got two, right? So let's just say this is the parasympathetic, and what's the other one? Sympathetic. And how many neurons does it take for this pathway to get to an effector organ? Right? For any kind of autonomic pathway, it's going to take two neurons, and not just one, as in a somatic motor pathway. And again, one is the preganglionic, the other is postganglionic. So if this is sympathetic, this third line over here, what's the neurotransmitter that's used here? It's acetylcholine. Really? Acetylcholine. So it's the same for both. Yeah, I agree with that. Furthermore, right, this ganglion is always going to be stimulated by acetylcholine. It's never going to inhibit the postganglionic fiber. So what kind of receptor is in this postganglionic cell? Yeah, it's a nicotinic receptor just like the neuromuscular junction. All right, so neuromuscular junction and the synapses in ganglia are nicotinic receptors, always excitatory. They cause depolarization because the sodium channel is going to open up. Okay, now what about the effector organs? What are some examples of effector organs in the autonomic nervous system? You should know three. I heard one. Heart. Smooth muscle. And glands. Some people are saying cardiac muscle, but that's what my diagram here was supposed to show. Okay? Oh, you thought that was a kidney. No, that's a heart. Okay? Cardiac muscle. So these are the three effectors. So for somatic motor, it's only skeletal muscle, but for autonomic nervous system, it's everything else in your body. All right. So what is, for the parasympathetic nervous system, what is the usual neurotransmitter for the postganglionic fiber? It is going to be acetylcholine. What about for the sympathetic postganglionic fiber? This is going to be norepinephrine. Okay. All right, so we have seen that the nicotinic kinds of receptors are just ligand-gated channels, like for sodium. But these over here are not nicotinic. These are what we... So the nicotinic channels are ionotropic receptors because they open up channels for ions. But these receptors over here, right? Change the metabolism inside the cell. These are metabotropic receptors. And so what do we call these? A general name. They're not nicotinic. These are muscarinic. All right, so these are all muscarinic. And these all rely on G-protein-coupled receptors. And G-protein-coupled receptors sometimes can be excitatory or they can be inhibitory, depending on the mechanism. All right, so for instance, on the heart, parasympathetic stimulation on the heart, is it going to speed the heart up or slow the heart down? It's going to slow the heart down. That's another way of saying inhibitory. So is this muscarinic receptor going to open up a sodium channel or a potassium channel? Right? So this is going to open up a potassium channel and slow the heart down. And there are different kinds of muscarinic receptors. And on the heart, I can't recall exactly which one it is. I think it's the M5 muscarinic receptor. Okay. All right, let's talk about sympathetic nervous system. Okay, sometimes the effector organ, whether it's heart, smooth muscle, or a gland, for instance, will be either stimulated or inhibited by norepinephrine. So again, you would say, how would you explain that? Different receptor types. All right, so if a system is using acetylcholine, remember that's what we call cholinergic? What do we call a system that uses norepinephrine? Adrenergic? So what kinds of adrenergic receptors are there? There's two general classes of adrenergic receptors. There are the alpha, and there's the beta. Furthermore, there are different kinds of alpha receptors and different kinds of betas. And I think in this class we got to know alpha 1, okay, beta 1, and beta 2. All right, the alpha 1, what is the response of the alpha 1s all the time? Alpha 1s are going to be excitatory. For instance, causing constriction of smooth muscle. And the beta 1, who knows what beta 1s are going to do? Are they going to be excitatory or inhibitory? These are excitatory. And the beta 2 are inhibitory. All right, so these are inhibitory. So where can we find these receptors? You should have on the tip of your tongue where some of these receptors are located. Let's start with an easy one. What's the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the heart? It's going to be antagonistic to the parasympathetic nervous system, and you already said parasympathetic stimulation here does what? Decreases heart rate. So what's the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the heart? It increases heart rate. So, okay, the receptors that the heart has are the beta ones because these are excitatory. It causes depolarization of the nodal cells and the muscle cells. It increases both the rate and force of contraction in the heart. So if somebody has high blood pressure, for instance, and we want to decrease the activity of the heart to lower their blood pressure, guess what we can use? A drug that inhibits, right, these beta 1 receptors. What do we call those? We mentioned those, I think. Those are called what? Beta blockers. So that decreases the contractility of the heart. All right, what about these beta 2s? Where could we find beta 2 receptors? What kind of muscles do we want to inhibit, maybe, to increase some function of an organ? The beta 2 receptors we find in bronchioles, air passageways going to the lungs, right? And what determines the flow through a tube is the diameter of the tube. That's the overriding parameter that controls flow through a tube. And as the diameter of a tube increases, the flow increases. So it's directly related. So if somebody's having trouble breathing, because maybe they're having an asthmatic attack. What would we like to do to their bronchioles? Constrict them or dilate them? We need to dilate them, right? And so then those patients are given a beta 2 agonist, which is going to inhibit the smooth muscles of bronchioles, which means that they will relax and the bronchioles will dilate, and they'll have a much easier time breathing. Okay, now what about the alpha 1? Where do we find alpha 1s? Alpha 1s. Okay, blood vessels, for instance. Blood vessels will cause vasoconstriction. And when blood vessels vasoconstrict, that's going to have an effect on blood pressure. So just think of a balloon. You know, grab a balloon with two hands and squeeze a balloon. What happens to the pressure inside the balloon when you squeeze it? Does it go up or down? It goes up, right? So if smooth muscle on blood vessels squeeze down, right, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes up. So this is one way that you can control blood pressure very quickly in the body, but it will also then control blood flow as well to various organs. All right, but don't forget, the alpha ones are usually excitatory, or are excitatory. The beta ones are excitatory. The beta twos are inhibitory. Okay. So that's kind of a review. And you have some exam figures, of course, that you just absolutely have to memorize, and that will help you answer the multiple choice questions that you would see on these different kinds of receptors. All right, the alpha 2s we're not going to cover in this class, but those are receptors in the brain that have effects that we're not always very sure about. Okay, so let's move out of the nervous system and go into senses. That's chapter 10. Okay, so sensory receptors are necessary for you to communicate with your environment. In order for you to perceive some kind of energy in your environment, you have to have a receptor for it. In order for you to perceive a stimulus, you have to have the proper kind of receptor. And what a receptor does is that it transduces or it changes some information or energy in the environment into action potentials. And action potentials are the little elements that, that's the language that your brain works on. That's how your brain thinks in terms of action potentials. Okay, so don't forget, as the intensity of a stimulus increases, what happens to an action potential? Or what about an action potential changes? Does the height or the amplitude of an action potential change? Or the width change? Or what? Oh, it's the frequency. That's right. So your brain appreciates intensity just by listening to the number of blips of an action potential as it's presented to certain part of the cerebral cortex. So that's the language of the nervous system. So each type responds to a particular form of energy, which is what we call a modality. So we can talk about some different modalities. For instance, sound is a mechanical wave in air. And light is another kind of energy. It's a wave, but it's not a mechanical wave. It's an electromagnetic wave. And other kinds of modalities would be maybe the presence of a chemical or the concentration of a chemical. Other kinds of modalities might be pressure that are going to change and deform a membrane, a cell membrane. And that could be blood pressure, or that could be pressure on the surface of your body. Let's see, what's another kind of modality? Maybe things that you smell as a result of odorant molecules in the air. Right? That is just the presence of a chemical. So these are all different modalities, and they require different kinds of receptors. Okay, and you have the perception of that modality because, depending on that receptor, it will send action potentials to different parts of the central nervous system. And we talked about that when we looked at the central nervous system. So, for instance, action potentials being generated by your eye go to what part of your central nervous system? What part of your central nervous system do they end up for your perception? What lobe of the brain? in particular? The occipital lobe, way in the back. Okay? Okay? Hearing goes to the temporal lobe. So if you were to artificially stimulate the occipital lobe, you would have the perception of sight, of vision. It might not be very pretty, right? It'd just be a splash of colors. It might not make a lot of sense. All right? For hearing, the primary auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe. So if you stimulate the temporal lobe electrically, then you'll have the perception of sound. All right? So that's how reality is generated by the depolarization of neurons on the cerebral cortex. Okay. So sensory receptors can be simple dendritic neurons, right? Like, for instance, neurons that maybe surround a hair follicle or other free nerve endings that we have in the dermis right here. Or they might be specialized nerve endings, like this Pacinian corpuscle that is surrounded by an specialized epithelial tissue that excite this neuron right here. And I'll give you some different examples of these in a little bit. All right, so sensory receptors can be grouped according to the type of stimulus that they transduce. Chemoreceptors sense chemical stimuli. And for instance, what about pH? Would that be a good example of a chemoreceptor? What is pH again? It's a measure of what? It's a measure of the hydrogen ion concentration, which is what? Just a measure of the concentration of a particular chemical in your body, which is what? The hydrogen ion. So pH receptors are chemoreceptors. They can measure chemicals. Photoreceptors transduce light. And when we say transduce, what does that mean? It means it can change light energy into action potentials, which then go to the brain and in particular the occipital lobe to give you the perception of light. Thermoreceptors respond to temperature changes. Mechanoreceptors are very common. They respond to changes in the shape of a cell membrane. And so vibration and touch are mechanoreceptors, but also hearing is a result of a mechanoreceptor because sound waves are mechanical waves in air. Nociceptors, probably haven't heard of these before, but these respond to tissue damage. All right, so they signal pain. So pain is a very important kind of sense to have. And proprioceptors or proprioceptors signal position in different parts of your body. You have proprioceptors in muscles that tell your brain, especially the cerebellum, what the tension in a muscle is. You have proprioceptors in tendons, and you have proprioceptors in joint capsules saying what the angulation of a joint is. So even with your eyes closed, you can tell what body position you're in. So if I were to have somebody close their eyes and grab their arm and put their hand above their head, guess what they could tell me? Where their hand was. And they would say, oh yeah, my hand's above my head, even without knowing that. Without looking. Okay, so sensory receptors can also be categorized by their location. And your book says special senses versus cutaneous senses or cutaneous receptors. I would maybe change that a little bit. Cutaneous is pretty good, but I would maybe say general versus special. And let's look at some of these senses as to why we call them that. For instance, a general sense or a cutaneous sense, we can see temperature or pain or pressure. For instance, if I were to take an ice cube and if I were to put that on your ear, could you feel that it was cold? Absolutely. And if I put it on your back, could you tell it was cold? What about your belly button or your kneecap? All right, no matter where I took that ice cube and placed it on your body, you could tell me if it was hot or cold, and of course you would say it was cold. So general senses have receptors all over your body. No matter where you look, you're going to have those kinds of receptors. And the same thing for pain. If I took a pin and I stuck you in the earlobe, right, or on your scalp or elbow or whatever, you could tell that there was a pin poking you there. And the same thing for touch and pressure. Okay, so these are what we call general senses because you have these receptors all over your body, especially on your skin. And so sometimes that's why we call these cutaneous receptors, as opposed to special senses. Right? These are due to receptors that you have only in one or two parts of your body. So that's why we call them special, and these are actually in your head. So for instance, what are some special senses? Light. Vision is a special sense. Because if I were to take a flashlight in a dark room and shine it on your belly button, could you see it? No. Okay, or your elbow or your kneecap. You couldn't see it. Only if I shined it in your eye could you see it. So you have photoreceptors in two locations in your body, not all over your body, but just your eyes, and they're special organs. They're special. They have complicated structures. So a special sense means that it's a complicated sensory organ, and it's only located in one or two places in your body. Also, the same thing for taste. That's a special sense. So if I took a sugar cube and put it on your elbow, could you taste it? No. Or your back? No. Or belly button? No. You'd have to put that chemical on your tongue in order for you to taste it. So taste is a special sense as well. You have special organs on your tongue that give you the perception of taste. So we talked about sight and taste. The official name for taste is the gustatory sense. Gustatory. All right, what about smell? If I took some perfume, and again, put it on your kneecap, could you smell it? No. The only place where you can smell is with your nose. And there's a special sensory organ in your nose that gives you the perception of smell. And what do we call that sense of smell? Anybody know what the official physiologic term for smell is? That's olfaction, right? The olfactory sense. And again, that's a special sense because you can only smell with your nose, not any other part of your body. All right, so we talked about vision and taste and olfaction and the same thing for hearing, right? If I took a tuning fork and put it on your toe, could you hear it? No. You have to have ears in order to hear something. So again, very limited places in your body that you can hear, and it's a special sensory organ. So it's a complicated sensory organ and only two limited places, namely your ear. So that's why it's a special sense. And then also, we're going to talk about equilibrium. There are two senses of equilibrium, and you're probably not really familiar with these, unless you've taken maybe an introductory physiology class. These are special senses as well. For equilibrium, there's one called kinetic equilibrium. And the other is called static equilibrium. And these give your brain a sense of position, body position, and motion. So these things help keep your balance when you're in motion. We're going to look at these. These are also associated with the ear. There's only two places, the right and left ear, where you get the sense of dynamic or kinetic equilibrium and static equilibrium. So those are also special senses. All right, so that's the list. Okay, those five right there. And I guess I want to stop the program for a second and then come back. What slide is that? Number 8? Okay, and let's go to... All right, so on the website, if you want to look at a little tutorial about the difference between general and special senses, all right, just look at this video right here. So this is just maybe like one of the videos that you've seen before. Maybe after class I can boot this up for you. And it's just a PowerPoint presentation that's narrated. All right, so you can go over some of these slides once again. Okay. Let me go back. And this is what I want. Okay. So different kinds of sensory receptors behave to stimulus in two general ways. Okay. Some receptors will always send action potentials to the brain depending on the amplitude or the strength of the stimulus, right? And remember, as the stimulus strength increases, the width of an action potential doesn't change, the height of an action potential doesn't change, just the frequency at which it is sent to the brain changes. So as the intensity gets higher or greater, right? The frequency is greater. They're directly related to each other. But not all receptors respond the same way. So if we have these two diagrams, A and B right here, and we apply the stimulus at the same time and keep it on for the same duration, we turn the stimulus off at the same time, we see that the behavior of action potentials is different between case one and case two down over here. All right, so case one, notice that the frequency of action potentials, how would you describe the frequency of action potentials during that period of time when the stimulus is turned on? Does it look like it's changing at all, the frequency of action potentials? It's not changing. It's the constant frequency. When we turn the stimulus on, an action potential is elicited, and then another, and another, and another. And then when we turn the stimulus off, the action potential is no longer generated, and it goes away altogether. So this is what we call a slowly adapting or a non-adapting kind of receptor or a tonic receptor. So tonic stays the same frequency no matter how long we leave the stimulus applied to that receptor. All right. In case two over here, what happens to the action potential? Does it look the same when we turn the stimulus on compared to when we turn the stimulus off? Looks like there's something changing here. Is it the amplitude? It's actually what? The frequency, right, of the action potential actually slows down the longer we leave the stimulus on. All right, so we call this a phasic type receptor or a fast adapting receptor. And these are real important because there are certain receptors that would drive us nuts if they were to be tonic. For instance, all the pressure receptors on your body are phasic receptors, and when you put clothes on, it stimulates those pressure receptors. And what would happen if you were acutely aware all day long of your socks on your feet and your shoes on your feet and all the clothes that you were wearing all day long? Okay, that would drive you nuts. So after a period of time, because they're fast adapting receptors, you just don't pay attention to that stimulus anymore. All right, so phasic receptors respond with a burst of activity, but quickly reduce the firing rate with constant stimulation. So touch is an important phasic kind of receptor, as well as smell. You probably are aware that when you walk into a building that has a particular odor, after a short period of time, you probably don't smell that odor anymore. Right? And then if you walk outside and walk back in the room, you smell that smell once again, because olfaction are rapidly adapting or phasic kinds of receptors. Other kinds of receptors, you don't want to, or it's not beneficial to have them operate in a phasic manner. You want them to operate in a tonic manner. So what kind of information don't you ever want to be able to ignore? Like things that are damaging your body, right? Things that are causing tissue damage. It would not be beneficial to have those receptors operate in a phasic manner, because you would always like to be aware of tissue damage so that you can avoid or move your body away from those circumstances. So pain, for instance, pain receptors are tonic receptors. Other kinds are what we call phasic kinds of receptors. All right, so there's a law of specific nerve energies that states that stimulation of a sensory fiber evokes only the sensation of that modality. So for instance, if we were to stimulate the olfactory nerve, you wouldn't have the sense of pressure or pain or vision. You would have the sense of smell, because it's going to go to this part of the cortex for smell. All right, the same thing for vision. If we stimulate the optic nerve, you're not going to have the sense of smell or pressure or touch. You're just going to have the perception of light, for instance. All right, so we call that the adequate stimulus. A particular stimulus is what we call the normal stimulus that requires the least amount of energy to activate that particular kind of receptor. And sometimes it's a little ambiguous or paradoxical, because, for instance, there are different kinds of temperature receptors that you have in your body. Some respond to cold, some respond to hot. And it just so happens that the hot receptors, Actually, the cold receptors also respond to hot when it gets really, really hot. And it gives you a paradoxical sensation of cold. Have you ever been in the shower and then something all of a sudden happens to the water temperature and it gets really hot? Like maybe somebody flushes the toilet. Okay, and the water gets really, really hot and you feel it hot all of a sudden, but what else do you feel? You feel a very cold sensation because temperature receptors for hot also can be stimulated by cold when it gets, the cold receptors get stimulated by heat when it's beyond that physiological range. All right, so that doesn't mean, for instance, that photoreceptors, for instance, which are most sensitive, what kind of stimulus is the most efficient for stimulating photoreceptors? That's going to be light. That would be, so for a photoreceptor, the adequate stimulus would be light. But there are other kinds of stimuli that can stimulate a photoreceptor. For instance, have you ever hit your head real hard, right? And you had trauma to your head, and it deforms the retina, right? It changes the shape of these photoreceptor cells, and that sends action potentials to the brain as well, right? That's not the adequate stimulus. It's kind of an inappropriate stimulus, but nonetheless, hopefully none of you have actually seen stars if you've hit your head really hard, but that would be an example of what the non-adequate stimulus stimulating the photoreceptor cells that send signals to the occipital lobe, and you actually see that noise pattern is light. Okay, so here's a table that shows different kinds of receptors and what the adequate stimulus is, like mechanoreceptors, some kind of mechanical force applied to that receptor. Pain receptors are due to tissue damage. When certain tissues are damaged, they release chemicals that excite sensory neurons. Chemoreceptors are sensitive to dissolved chemicals in body fluids, right? And they usually affect ionic permeability of cells, causing depolarization, for instance, which brings a neuron to a threshold, which is going to cause an action potential. And of course, photoreceptors are most sensitive to light, but they can respond to all of these different stimuli, but it's just most efficient for what? It's adequate stimulus. Okay, so receptor cells are going to produce graded potentials, right? So remember, graded potentials can take different amplitudes which are directly related to the stimulus intensity. And these are equivalent to EPSPs at synapses. So these are always going to be excitatory potentials which bring a sensory neuron toward threshold. And if it reaches threshold, then that sensory neuron is going to generate an action potential which will travel down the nerve axon. All right, so as a review for the test on Monday, what kind of neuron is a sensory neuron by its structure, by its shape? What kind of neuron is a sensory neuron? There's actually two of them. One was, we said, only for very special senses, and now you know what a special sense is. Bipolar for special senses that we're going to see in the eye, for instance. And what's another kind of sensory neuron? It's the unipolar or pseudo-unipolar. Right. Okay, so generator potentials are produced in response to that adequate stimulus in a receptor cell of some kind. And then your brain will appreciate the amplitude of the stimulus by the number of action potentials that reach the cerebral cortex in that particular region for that kind of modality. So generator potentials are proportional to stimulus intensity. They're directly related. And after the threshold is reached, action potential frequency is proportional to the amplitude of the generator potential. Right? So what did we call that? That was a way of frequency coding stimulus intensity. So your brain doesn't understand intensity in terms of changes in the height of the action potential, only in the frequency of action potentials reaching the cerebral cortex. And in phasic receptors, so what kind of receptor again was a phasic one? Was that the fast adapting or the slow adapting? That's the fast adapting, right? So in fast adapting receptors, The generator potential adapts to a constant stimulus and quickly diminishes in amplitude. So what changes for a phasic kind of receptor system is not the sensory neuron, but it's the receptor itself that is changing how it stimulates the neuron. And it changes by decreasing the generator potential or the graded potential that it is producing. All right, so in a tonic receptor, generator potential does not adapt to a constant stimulus. So let's look at this graph right here. We have action potentials on the first line. We have generated potentials on the second line, and then we have the stimulus that is going to cause these generator potentials, which then might cause action potentials. Right? So cause down on the bottom, and the effect as we move up in this diagram over here. All right, so our first stimulus is turned on and turned off, and it's producing this generator potential. And how would we talk about this generator potential right here? Is it causing an action potential? It's not. So if there is a stimulus that's not causing an action potential, we would say it is sub-threshold, right? It's sub-threshold. It hasn't reached threshold right here. All right, and as we increase the stimulus intensity, what happens to the generator potential intensity? It increases as well. All right, but in this particular case, it is no longer sub-threshold. It is a threshold potential, right? And in this particular case, it's not a very high intensity, so it's only going to cause 4 action potentials. So what would you use to explain this gap between action potentials right here with this barely threshold stimulus? How come it's not a high frequency? How come it's just a slow frequency? What about an action potential can you use to explain why there's this big gap between action potentials right here? Okay, so make sure you can draw out an action potential. All right, and the two main parts of it, what are the two main parts of an action potential? You've got depolarization, repolarization, not quite like that, but that's close. All right, so right here is what? This is the threshold potential, but before that, this is what? RMP. All right, so we got depolarization. So this right here is stimulus. Here's depolarization. Here's repolarization. And here's resting membrane potential here. But after repolarization, what happens? Hyperpolarization. So this is what we call, sorry about the podium right there. This is what we call what? The relative refractory period. And that threshold stimulus is not strong enough to overcome this relative refractory period. So when is the next possible time in stimulus number 2 that we can elicit another action potential? Way up over here. All right? So there's a big gap between action potentials because that threshold stimulus can't overcome this area of hyperpolarization. So you have a slower frequency of action potentials. But in the third case, look at that stimulus. It's way above threshold, right? So it's producing a very large generative potential so that as soon as the absolute refractory period is over and it goes into hyperpolarization, that generated potential is still strong enough to overcome this relative refractory period. So as soon as the absolute refractory period is over, what happens? Another action potential, right? More quickly in time. So that's exactly what your brain hears, whether it's smell intensity or visual intensity, right, or sound intensity. Your brain is going to hear, if it's just barely a threshold stimulus, it's going to hear a blip, 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 blip. But if it's a high intensity, your brain is going to hear what? Blip, 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 blip. Right? And it's going to be either a smell sensation or a visual sensation or auditory sensation. It doesn't matter. It's just going to be these blips right here. Okay, so generator potential is directly related to the or the amplitude of a generator potential is directly related to the frequency of action potentials reaching the brain. Okay, cutaneous sensations. Again, cutaneous, I would probably rather have you say just general sensations. Why would we call these general senses? Because they're all over your body. You have millions of receptors all over your body. And these would be due to temperature receptors, pain receptors, right, and pressure and touch receptors. There's another kind of receptor that I talked about on the first slide, and it had to do with muscle tension, tension in tendons and ligaments, and a position of joints. You have these receptors all over your body. So would you call those general or special? They're general. But they have a really funny name. What did we call those receptors that give your body the sense of body position and tension and muscles? What do we call those? Those are what we call proprioceptors. So proprioceptors sounds like a real special name, but is that a special sense? And why or why not? Are proprioceptors special? I would say no, because why? You have them all over your body. Because you have them all over in every muscle, every tendon, every joint. They're really a general sense. Okay. All right, so general senses include touch, pressure, heat, cold, pain. Some can be mediated by free as well as encapsulated nerve endings. Free nerve endings mediate temperature and pain, and encapsulated nerve endings give you the sense of touch and vibration. So cold receptors are located in the superficial dermis. Warm receptors are in the deeper regions of the dermis, just by location. Pain is mediated by nociceptors. These are actually just free nerve endings that are sensitive to substances released from damaged tissue, like substance P, for instance, and glutamate. So we call these pain neurotransmitters. Substance P is a pain neurotransmitter. I don't have a picture of what substance P looks like, but that's probably okay. You don't know what acetylcholine necessarily looks like either. So just remember, substance P is a pain neurotransmitter. Heat elicits pain through capsaicin receptors. And capsaicin is just a chemical that is found in certain kinds of chili peppers, like hot chili peppers. So the chemicals in these peppers bind to capsaicin receptors, and it gives you the perception of heat or hot, right, in that part of the body that you apply that chemical to. But it doesn't produce a burn like temperature does. It just gives you the perception of burning. All right, so different kinds of receptors in the integument. Ruffini's and Merkel's discs are slow adapting, and these are just free nerve endings. All right, so Ruffini and Merkel's are slow adapting, as opposed to some of these more complicated ones, like this Pacinian corpuscle and a Meissner's corpuscle over here. All right, Meissner's and Pacinian corpuscles are rapidly adapting. These are encapsulated nerve endings. These are all for mediating touch. So some are rapidly adapting, some are slowly adapting, and these Pacinian corpuscles are what? Really deep in the dermis. So if someone were to squeeze your hand rather rapidly, the Pacinian corpuscles would send that information to your brain very rapidly and say, oh, somebody's squeezing your hand. But if someone were to squeeze your hand for a long time, okay, guess what would happen? Since they're rapidly adapting, you would lose that sense after probably about 15 or 30 seconds. All right, you can try that with each other after class. Grab somebody's fingertip and pinch it. And when you first pinch it, you're going to go, ow, right? But after about 30 seconds, you're just not going to feel that pinching in it. What? Not now, after class. Okay, and that's because one is a tonic receptor and the other is what? A more phasic kind of receptor. Okay, so here's just a little table that reiterates what we talked about already. All right. Somatesthetic senses. So somatesthetic, these refer to, anytime you hear this somato, this is going to be on the surface of your body. All right, so cutaneous as well as proprioceptors. Information is carried by large myelinated nerve fibers up the dorsal column of the spinal cord and then to the postcentral gyrus, because that's what? That's the primary somatosensory cortex, right? As opposed to the primary motor cortex, which is the front in the frontal lobe, the precentral gyrus. Heat, cold, and pain are carried by the lateral spinal thalamic tract. That's probably good for you to know. All right, that pain is carried by the lateral spinal thalamic tract, and other kinds of pressure and touch information goes through the anterior spinal thalamic tract. All right, so the lateral is pain, anterior is more common kinds of sensation. But now, what can you tell me about these tracts right here? Just by nomenclature. I think it's important for you to know nomenclature. When you say spinal thalamic, is that efferent or afferent tract? Is it motor or is it sensory? Okay, well, from the slide, you could probably figure that out. You're going to say, well, it's sensory because we're talking about sensory receptors right here, right? So these are sensory pathways. Another name for sensory is afferent. And how on earth are you going to know that when you look at this big complicated name? Spinal thalamic tract, because a lot of times in anatomy, the first part of the word is the origin, and the second part of the word is the destination, right? Or the origin and insertion. So the first part of this word is the spine, like spinal cord. The second part is the thalamus. And what the heck is the function of the thalamus? It's a relay center for sensory information. Things coming up the spinal cord have to synapse in the thalamus before it can go to the proper location in the cerebral cortex for your perception. Okay, so spinal thalamic is always going to be a sensory tract. And the lateral is for pain. Probably should know that one. Okay, receptive field. Different parts of your body, in terms of general senses, have different densities of receptors. And so the receptive field is an area on the skin whose stimulation results in changes in the rate of action potentials in that sensory neuron. The area varies inversely with the density of receptors. For instance, the back and legs have very low density of sensory receptors. So the receptive field is very large. So in areas that have very large receptive fields, one way to measure that is with your two-point discrimination, which is probably what you did in a lab, running around poking each other with a pair of calipers or something, right? And in your back, in order to feel that you were being poked with two pins, right, then those two pins had to be separated by a very large distance in order to stimulate two different receptive fields, because the receptive fields are large. And even if you look at that little homuncular diagram in the previous chapter, you could see that the surface of the brain, the number of neurons on the surface of the brain, maps very nicely to the size of the receptive field or the density of receptors in different parts of your body. So what area, again, had the highest number of receptors, or actually the smallest receptive field? Okay. It says fingertips right here, but there's actually one area that has even a higher density, and that is your lips. Your lips have the smallest receptive fields. Okay, and fingertips aren't bad. Okay. Well, chemical senses. We go to about 320. Seems like I've been talking for a lot longer than that today. Okay, taste and smell. All right, so what kind of sense is taste and smell? Is it a general sense or a special sense?
Special.
These are special because you don't have that ability to sense these modalities everywhere on your body, only a couple locations. All right, and these are what we call extroreceptors because they don't respond to something that's happening inside your body. They are being stimulated by something that's happening outside your body. So you have exteroreceptors and interoceptors. Those pressure receptors and pain receptors in your skin, they're relating, they're passing information to your brain for changes that are happening inside your body. So those would be interoceptors. Or you can have chemoreceptors inside your body that measure pH of your fluids. Right? Those would be interoceptors. But taste and smell are exteroceptors. All right, another name for taste is gustation, or the gustatory sense. And there are five primary taste sensations that you can taste with your tongue. And you have special sensory structures on your tongue that will sense each of these different four kinds of molecules. Or we can call these tastant molecules. There's sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and then a relatively new one, which is umami. Right, and that's the taste of deliciousness. Right, so umami is deliciousness, and that's due to amino acids. And as a matter of fact, you could probably look on the label of different kinds of foods. People always laugh when I say umami, and I'm wondering why. Am I mispronouncing it? Who knows how to say it correctly? I think that's fine. Okay. Okay. Yeah, it's an Asian language of some kind. I would guess Japanese, but I'm not exactly sure. All right, and so amino acids can stimulate these receptors, and if you look at the labels of foods, you can see that there is one amino acid that is placed in some foods to enhance its flavor, and it's glutamate. And on the label, you're going to see monosodium glutamate, or MSG. That will stimulate the umami receptors and increase your sense of satisfaction when you eat that kind of food. Now, some people are really allergic to monosodium glutamate. It can precipitate migraines or whatever. So if you have migraines, you probably would like to look at that particular label on food. Well, how is it that you can taste things? Well, here is an illustration of a part of your tongue, and I can see a cell right here. All right, and I can see a nerve ending. So what do you think the magnification of this diagram is? Would you need a microscope to see this thing? Absolutely, because these are just cells. These are really tiny things, right? So here we see a taste bud, right? So here is a taste bud. It's composed of, maybe 100 cells or so, but that's still a microscopic structure. So I think the point that I'm trying to make is that a taste bud is microscopic. You can't see it unless you have a microscope. But if you stick your tongue out in a mirror, you can see things. You can see bumps on your tongue that people call taste buds. But if you see those things with your naked eye, can they be taste buds? No, because taste buds are microscopic. So the bumps and things on your tongue that you see are what we call papillae. And papillae are just structures that contain hundreds or thousands of these taste buds that are microscopic in nature. Okay, and every taste bud, right, is either going to be sensing sweet or sour, salty, bitter, or different kinds, or umami, different kinds of amino acids. All right, so sweet is going to be due to some kind of sugar compound that binds to a taste hair. So here you see a taste cell with a taste hair on it. There are receptors in some cases. On this, it's like a microvilli or a cilium that projects off of this taste cell, which then can cause an action potential on this sensory nerve fiber that's going to take the signal to the gustatory cortex in the brain. And I'm not sure I mentioned where the gustatory cortex is. What lobe of the brain contains the gustatory cortex? That is it's in the insula. That's the fifth lobe of the brain that's behind the temporal lobe. So if you move the temporal lobes out of the way, you can see the insula, and that's the part of the cortex response that will, when it depolarizes, gives you the sense of taste in the insula. Okay, so each taste bud can respond to all categories of tastant molecules. So let's look and see how this might happen. All right, so these are really some nice diagrams that are in your book that explain it pretty nicely. So these are the taste cells, and here are the hairs coming off of a taste cell. They're not really hairs, they're just what? Projections of the cell membrane. And there can be certain kinds of receptors. But for instance, for the sensation of salt, guess what? What do you put on your food to make it taste salty? Sodium chloride, right? So you put sodium on the cell. And in these kinds of receptor cells, there are sodium channels, right? And where do you have these taste buds? Of course, you have them in your mouth. So if you put sodium in your mouth, it dissolves in saliva, and that sodium can enter through these channels. And when sodium enters this cell right here, what happens to it electrically? It depolarizes. So just by putting salt on your tongue, it stimulates these cells. So now it depolarizes. All right, and here we have some voltage-gated channels, calcium channels. When the cell depolarizes, the calcium is a signal for the release or the docking of these neurotransmitters, right, or these synaptic vesicles, which then release excitatory neurotransmitter on this gustatory neuron, which takes that action potential to the gustatory cortex in the insula. And it will then depolarize those neurons, giving you the sensation of saltiness. All right. What's another kind of sense? Sour. And sour is due to hydrogen ion. It's just the acidity, the amount of acidity in the food that you eat. And again, in this particular location, it's not a particular kind of receptor. What it is that it's a channel specifically for hydrogen ions. It's not specific for sodium ions, but for hydrogen. So when hydrogen enters the cell, what happens to the electrical properties of this taste cell? It depolarizes, right? Anytime you put a positive ion into the cell, it's going to cause depolarization. And this depolarization, again, is going to open these voltage-gated calcium channels, which is going to release excitatory neurotransmitter on this neuron, and it's going to go just to that part of the cerebral cortex and the insula that's going to give you the perception of sourness. All right, so here are two, salty and sour, just due to specific ion channels, either sodium or hydrogen ion. All right, what other senses do we have? Or whatever taste senses do we have? We got bitter. Okay. All right. We also have sweet and umami. They're similar to each other. All right. In this particular case, we do have receptors on these taste hairs, on the taste cells. These are G protein coupled receptors, so that when either a sugar molecule or amino acid, and it's going to be specific to one or the other, bind to this receptor, right? It's going to activate this G protein, which is going to cause the buildup of a second messenger inside the cell, right? So the tastant molecule never enters the cell like we saw in that first example for those different ions that actually got inside the cell. But here, because of this G protein coupled receptor, it's going to cause a second messenger to develop inside the taste cell. This second messenger is going to close potassium channels. All right, so what happens to the electrical properties of the cell when we close potassium channels? Well, let's step back a little bit, and if you have a potassium channel that's open, what does that mean? It's allowing for potassium to leave the cell. So what is happening to this taste cell when it's not being stimulated by sugars or amino acids? What is the membrane potential? If potassium can leave, what happens to a cell when potassium leaves? It hyperpolarizes, right? So this cell is normally hyperpolarized, which is what? Making it inhibited. It's moving it away from threshold, right? So it's hyperpolarized when there is no tastant molecule, but as soon as a tastant molecule binds to this G protein coupled receptor, right, these potassium channels close. So instead of becoming hyperpolarized, now it actually depolarizes because we're changing the permeability to potassium. All right, so the cell depolarizes. That increases the release of excitatory neurotransmitter, which then sends signals to the gustatory cortex in the cerebral hemispheres for your perception of taste. Okay, so don't forget If we let potassium leave the cell, it hyperpolarizes, but if we stop its release from the cell, that depolarizes it. It just works in the opposite direction. Okay, then the last case, bitter, the sense of bitter, and a good chemical compound that will stimulate bitter receptors is quinine. So what's that in? That's in a drink that you can get at the liquor store, grocery store. That's in tonic water. Okay, tonic water has quinine in it, which is a bitter taste. All right, so quinine will bind to receptor. This is a G-protein coupled receptor, which again causes the buildup of a second messenger inside the cell. And this second messenger doesn't work by changing the permeability of ion channels in the plasma membrane, right? It works by changing ion channels in sarcoplasmic reticulum, and in particular, smooth sarcoplasmic reticulum. And one of the jobs of smooth sarcoplasmic reticulum is that it's a reservoir for calcium. So smooth ER contains a lot of calcium. So when the second messenger builds up, it causes the release of calcium, and that release of calcium then causes docking and fusion of these synaptic vesicles, which release excitatory neurotransmitter on this gustatory neuron, which then goes to the, what part of the cerebral cortex again? The insula, right in the insula for taste, right? All right, so here are those five different senses and how they work. And you know what? This might be an exam figure. Is that an exam figure? Oh, you're not interested in this exam just yet. After Monday, you will be. Okay. So you're going to have to work through these different schemes right here. But it's actually very nice to see. All right, so the sense of olfaction. Now, is this a general or special sense? It's special as well. All right. Develops, again, because of receptor cells, all right, so you have olfactory receptor neurons, which have cilia or these little hair projections down into the nasal cavity. And these are really strange because these are really the only neurons in your body that actually dangle outside your body. They're just dangling there inside your nasal cavity. It's weird to have a neuron outside your body, but here is an example of that. And as a result, what do you think the lifespan of these neurons is? It's short because they're getting beat up all the time, right? Whatever you breathe in your body have access to these neurons. Oh, there's even a parasite that can bind to these cilia and get inside this bipolar cell and actually find its way to the brain. Maybe I can remember the name of that parasite. It happened to somebody that was water skiing in Lake Elsinore last year. No, not Giardia. It's another kind of it's a dinoflagellate. I'll have to look it up. Okay, but anyway, this is interesting because those neurons are actually outside your body. So it's a kind of parasite that lives in tropical lakes or subtropical lakes that don't ever freeze in the wintertime. This parasite can live in. So if you're water skiing in a lake in Minnesota or something, you don't ever have to worry about it. But in Southern California, I suppose, maybe you do. Okay, so where are these olfactory neurons at? Okay, they are they down here by this inferior nasal concha or the middle one? They're actually where? Way up in the superior part of the nasal cavity. So if you really want to smell something, can you just take a normal breath? Or if you really want to appreciate a smell, what do you have to do? You have to sniff it. That's right, because these receptors are way up over here in the superior part of the nasal cavity, so you got to get air up in that region so that odorant molecules can bind to receptors on these cilia right here. Okay, so these are bipolar neurons, and the central process of this bipolar neuron goes up through the cribriform plate, so these are olfactory foramina. These are just some things that you had to learn in anatomy. And then they enter the olfactory bulb, and we're not going to talk much about these other kinds of support interneurons, like mitral cells and things like that. But anyway, when an odorant molecule binds to its proper receptor on these receptor cells, all right, then they will send action potentials to the brain. Now, where is the olfactory cortex at? What part of the brain? What lobe is that? Okay, that's going to be in the temporal lobe. Okay, so olfactory cortex is temporal lobe, gustatory cortex is insula, and it's just going to be action potentials going to the temporal lobe, the proper location, and that's going to give you the perception of smell. Alright, so olfactory apparatus contains or consists of these receptor cells, supporting cells, and basal cells. The receptor cells are bipolar neurons that send axons to the olfactory bulb and then to the temporal lobe. The basal cells are stem cells that produce new receptor cells every 1 to 2 months. Alright, but what are the receptor cells? Can you see them again? They're actually, what, they're bipolar neurons. And then the other supporting cells in the epithelium right here contain enzymes that detoxify different kinds of compounds to help protect these bipolar neurons right here. All right, well, what is kind of startling about this to you? Is anything startling about this? Basal cells are stem cells that produce new neurons every 1 to 2 months. What have we always thought about nervous tissue? That it doesn't regenerate because there are no stem cells anywhere. So for instance, if somebody has a spinal cord injury, all right, they never recover from that because there are no cells, there are no stem cells anywhere in the spinal cord to replace the ones that are damaged. Okay, but what do we see here? Here's a perfect location where we can find nervous tissue that has stem cells, and maybe at some point in time, I think that would be really interesting if we could harvest some of these basal cells from somebody's nose and grow them into neurons to replace neurons that are damaged in their spinal cord. All right? Or maybe we can figure out how these stem cells are working in the nose and take stem cells from the spinal cord and have them regenerate spinal cord neurons, for instance. All right, so I think this is kind of interesting to know that here's an example where neurons can regenerate themselves. Well, what would happen if we were to take these stem cells from the nose and have them repopulate a damaged spinal cord? What? Huh? Well, maybe somebody could then start smelling with their back. I'm not sure. Okay, that's just sort of silly. But anyway, that's something that I kind of think about. Okay, who knows? Okay, so odor molecules bind to receptors and act every single time through a G-protein-coupled receptor. It's the most kind of common receptor in your body. And people talk about, just like in for taste, we said that there were 5 primary taste sensations. And people are talking all the time about the primary smell sensations, like flowery and etheric. And people will be probably talking about that for the next couple hundred years. There's no agreement if there are primary olfactory sensations and what they are, and it just all depends on the, probably on culture and the age of the individual and all kinds of variations that we just don't know very much about yet. Okay, but you could do a Google on primary olfactory sensations if you want to know the different kinds. Yeah.
Is there a receptor for every
type of smell? Yeah, as a matter of fact, the receptor the part of the DNA or chromosomes that code for that receptor protein, we know of thousands of them. So yeah, there are thousands of different kinds of receptor proteins in the nose, all specific to a certain kind of shape of a molecule. Yeah, so it takes up a huge amount of our genetic material to code for those different receptor proteins. And I suppose that makes sense because in humans, smell is not that important, but in all other animals, smell is probably the most important sense, right? So that's really how they actually see their way around the environment, is by just smelling different things. Okay. Ears and hearing. All right, so you know where the ear is, and deep inside the temporal bone, there's that petrous region, and inside, as a matter of fact, I want to show you this diagram first. I'm going to show you this diagram first. So this is slide number 48. Okay. So let's just talk about the ear. It's just general anatomy. Remember that the ear has an outer part, a middle part, and an inner part. And the inner ear is located in the petrous region of the temporal bone. So here is the inner part of the ear. The outer part contains the pinna or the auricle and your earlobe over here. In anatomy, we used to call, okay, this little flap right here. Anybody know what that little flap is called? It's kind of sticking out. That's called the tragus. Okay, the tragus. And then there's another little hard part across from the tragus that's attached to your earlobe. That's called the antitragus. I don't know if you any had to learn that, but the antitragus is kind of important. A lot of times it's used clinically because we like to tug on it. And when we pull on the antitragus, all right, what is that going to be a nice test for? Something that we call otitis media, which is an infection of the middle ear right here. And little kids get that all the time. So if you pull on that antitragus and the little kid starts screaming and yelling, then you know you've got otitis media or an infection of the middle ear, which is very, very common. Okay, so the antitragus is up over here. All right, well, that was just a little bit of an aside. Just to see what kind of anatomy class you guys were in. All right, so the outer ear contains, right, the auricle and the tragus, antitragus, as well as the external auditory meatus. And this is how sound energy enters the temporal bone. But notice that the external auditory meatus doesn't go continuously into your brain, because then you would just have a hole into your brain, right? There is a partition, which we call the tympanic membrane. And the tympanic membrane marks the end of the outer ear and the beginning of the middle ear. All right, the middle ear is an airspace, just like this external auditory meatus. There's only air in there. But this part of the ear transmits sound vibrations from the outside world to the inner ear. And it does so via three little bones. So we have the incus, malleus, and stapes. When sound enters the ear, that's a pressure wave. It's going to cause a vibration of the tympanic membrane, which is going to cause vibrations of the auditory ossicles. And the stapes, which is the last one, then transmits that vibration into the fluid that makes up the inner ear. Okay, and this apparatus in the inner ear is what we call the vestibular apparatus, which was that first slide that I showed you, the vestibular apparatus. Well, it's very difficult for sound energy to go from air into a fluid. You might be aware of that. If you've ever been swimming, for instance, and you ever dive underwater, and somebody's talking to you in a boat or on the deck of a swimming pool or something, and you go underwater, what do they sound like? Well, muffled, or they even like disappear because you can't hear them underwater. That's because sound energy has a very difficult time getting into water. Well, we have water or fluid in the inner ear right here, and that sound energy needs help getting in there. And that's the job of these auditory ossicles. It really amplifies the sound, and the best way of talking about it is that it just matches the impedance of the air with the impedance of water that's inside this middle ear. So it helps you hear. All right, so this is a necessary step in order to get sound vibrations into the inner ear. All right, so the pressure, all right, in the middle ear should be the same pressure as the outer ear. Let's just say that the pressure in the middle ear right here was higher than the outer ear. What would happen to this tympanic membrane? If the pressure is higher in the middle ear, it would get pushed out, right? And if the pressure is high enough in the middle ear, then the tympanic membrane won't even vibrate. It will just get pushed all the way to one end. And if the tympanic membrane can't vibrate, what's going to happen to your sense of hearing? You won't hear anything because the tympanic membrane has got to vibrate. So there's a special passageway that equalizes the air pressure on either side of this tympanic membrane so it never builds up, so that the tympanic membrane can always vibrate. And that is the Eustachian tube, or the pharyngotympanic tube, or sometimes we call that the auditory tube. So it goes between your pharynx, which is your throat, and the middle ear. That equalizes the pressure. But for instance, if you ever get a cold, or for instance, if you have a middle ear infection, or the flu or something, or a sore throat that inflames this area, that closes that tube, Well, you might have difficulty hearing because you can't equalize pressure. How could you equalize pressure under most conditions? If maybe you're in an airplane or something and you change barometric pressure very quickly, how can you equalize the pressure on either side of this tympanic membrane? Yawning, chewing gum. Maybe if you know you have a cold and you're going to be on an airplane, take an antihistamine or something, or an anti-inflammatory, which will then, or a nasal decongestant that will open this tube up so you have an easier time equalizing pressure. So yawning, chewing gum, maybe holding your nose and blowing into your nose. So what kind of individual, I'll just end real quick here, what kind of individual commonly can have middle ear infections? Children, yes, swimmers, children, for instance, surfers, but especially little kids, right? And even newborn babies, neonates, and when they're placed on an airplane and if they have a middle ear infection, all right, they're probably screaming after takeoff or when somebody's landing because you can tell them, oh, clear your ears, right? Do a little Valsalva maneuver or move your jaw back and forth. But what is a little one-year-old going to do when you tell them that? Well, they're going to look at you like lovingly but not have the slightest idea what you're talking about. In the meantime, this tympanic membrane is being pushed to one side or the other, and they're just kind of screaming in agony as a result of that. So if you know your child has an infection or has a bad cold or something and you're going to hop on an airplane, I would maybe talk to your physician and see if there's some kind of medication that they can be placed on, like a nasal decongestant. But I would talk to a physician. Don't just buy something in the store and give it to your little kids. Okay? All right, so next time we'll finish up with the ear and move on to the eye. No, we can't do that next time, can we? Because what do we have next time? We got a test. Got to get a test over with. Yeah. When you burn it, because of chemical or because of hot? By heat. It's like burning your skin. It will hopefully regenerate itself. You know, it will rebuild itself. One little area. You know, I think sometimes you can get like a little infection, maybe a viral infection someplace that's going to produce a little inappropriate sensation. You know, I mean, you might feel it like for what? Like for half a day or something? Yeah. 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 It's probably due to a little viral infection that's neither here nor there. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to turn my microphone off.